You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and today I've rented License to Kill. Watching it with me is Pete Brooker from the From Tailors with Love podcast. Hi, Pete, how are you?
Very well, Rich. How are you doing today?
I'm very good. Welcome to the Betamax Video Club, finally. It's the fifth of five 80s Bond films. We're finally here. It's License to Kill. What is so special about this film for you?
Well, first off, Rich, thanks for inviting me onto the podcast. License to Kill, I really like because it's very Tim. I mean, this one was written especially for Tim. I think The Daylights was adapted for Timmy, if I'm right. And by the way, if I get any of the facts wrong on this show, then if everyone can just email Rich, that'd be handy.
My inbox is full.
Yeah, I was telling you off air that I actually had Bondologist written on my Twitter account once, but then I actually met people that knew things about Bond, so I took that off. I really like License to Kill, partly because of some of the locations that I've been to since watching the film. So a lot of it resonates with me because I've visited quite a few places in the film.
Well, that was something that we spoke about when we first arranged to do this. I think it was just before you'd gone off to Florida. And I mean, some of the locations in here, I know they were filmed in Key West and they did huge parts of the filming in Mexico. But in terms of, you know, some of them, you said you'd been to the Barrelhead Bar.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite what you expected.
Not really. Well, I haven't been to Mexico. I think they did a lot of filming in the studios out there in Mexico, like Cherubusco Studios. This was like one of the first films to be away from Pinewood, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, went to the Barrelhead Bar. Really excited to go to this location, but only found out afterwards that they filmed the inside in the film set in the studios. It was the outside, the exteriors, that was actually featured in the film. But in the inside, there was really nothing to relate to the film. There was one poster of License to Kill sat weirdly on the wall, dislocated from everything else, and there was a couple of guys underneath the poster, and I got talking to them and said, like, wow, can you tell me anything about the place? Were you here? Are you locals? And they said, oh yeah, we're here all the time. Were you here when they filmed License to Kill? And they said, oh yeah, I forget that was filmed here. It was one of these weird kind of Ricky Gervais moments almost, where if they were to pan out and you saw this huge poster they were sitting underneath of License to Kill. So yeah, some of the places didn't quite live up to expectation, but it's still an amazing place to go to Key West, and some of the places really did.
This was, I suppose, after I'd seen The Living Daylights at the cinema, and that was the first Bond film I'd seen. This was rated as a 15 in the UK, and there were some conversations that were had that the original cut that was submitted should have been an 18. Now, I was 9 at the time this came out, so there was no chance in hell of me seeing it, and I mean, the tone of this film, we talked about it off air again, this is so different from any previous, or I suppose certain subsequent Bond films, but it was very much in keeping of the time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, even everything down to the score is remarkably set in the 80s. I mean, there's no escape from this 80s prism that this film is filmed in. The style, again, is very casual. I mean, we'll probably talk about that later on, but it really was quite ahead of its time in the grittiness. Dalton wanted to have this very gritty Fleming Bond on screen. That's what he was very passionate about in portraying the character. And so, yeah, you look at the Rogers and then you look at the Daltons. I mean, it's was it chalk and cheese? Is that the phrase? Something like that. But it really is. And then you have this section of Brosnan between Dalton and Craig, and that almost feels slightly out of place if you're carrying on this trajectory of how Bond should be portrayed. But that's just conjecture, really, on my behalf.
I mean, I was lucky. This film was shown at the Prince Charles, and I mean, we bumped into each other there, the Prince Charles Cinema in London.
We did.
It was the 30th anniversary of the film. And I was quite lucky enough afterwards to be invited to talk on the Odd Job podcast by Terry.
Great.
And one of the points that came up quite regularly about that was this movie, unlike any other Bond film, it was an action film that in all essence you could kind of remove it from the Bond universe and it would stand quite easily on its own as an 80s action film.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the Bond films, they're so indebted to Bond, the character and the writing, whereas this, you know, it's so gritty and violent, and the theme of the villain being a drug lord rather than some man who lives under the sea or has dreams of living in space. It's so contemporary. It's looking back at it now, it's strange because parts of it have aged, you know, quite a lot because of the way it was made. But, you know, even now you think it works so well because it's a lot more realistic.
It does. And like, if you look at, so you're right, that's the word that I think I was trying to grope for, was contemporary. And if you look at the other films that were released around this date, I think you had RoboCop, Beverly's Hill Cop 2, I'm sure there was a Lethal Weapon somewhere in this, and it's all very much drug related, drug lords, cops versus villains, but with the undercurrent of drugs. So yeah, you're right, it really does fit into that world, and that's probably why people associate this with, perhaps don't associate it as being a Bond film compared to all the other films.
One thing that, or a theme that seems to pop up throughout this film, is its association with Die Hard.
Right, yeah.
Now obviously you've got Robert Davi, who was Special Agent Johnson.
Yeah.
In that. you've also got Felix Leiter's buddy, Grandel Bush, who was
right.
The other Special Agent Johnson.
Right, okay. Yeah. Were they called Johnson in the film, or was it just in the credits?
Both called, they're both called Johnson, and then at one point, I think Davi said no relation.
Okay, yeah.
I'm Agent Johnson. This is Special Agent Johnson.
Oh, how you doing?
No relation.
Yeah. The score was by Michael Kamen, who did Die Hard as well.
Yeah.
And there was also something I noticed towards the end when the Japanese businessmen were paying for access to the drugs in negotiable bearer bonds, which was the most 80s currency ever. Talked about it on the Beverly Hills Cop pod because that was something that came up there as well. And again, it's strange because I know other podcasts, other publications have written about the links between Bond films and cinema at the time, and I think the most blatant example is probably Live and Let Die, which, you know, with its whole blaxploitation angle,
yeah,
perhaps hasn't dated so well either, but at least, you know, it was obvious what they were going for.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, the Davi connection there is great, and I just love him in Die Hard because he's so cocksure, you know, he's got the baseball cap on backwards, he's like a 12-year-old up in that plane with a huge gun. He's like, it's just like being back in Nam.
And that was it, you know, you've got
get blown up. Yeah.
And the other Johnson saying, I was at junior high, dickhead.
Yeah. Brilliant. Oh, I'm gonna go watch Die Hard.
It's not Christmas yet.
Yeah.
This film opens and this kind of sets the tone for the whole angle, which now for the current Bond films, we've not had one for 4 years, but the most recent Bond film seemed to be about Bond on some sort of personal vendetta. You know, whether it's to do with the loss of Vesper or even M. This was pretty much the first one because he is in Florida for the wedding of Felix Leiter. And as I suppose is quite common in that world, you're never really off duty, because as they're in the car on the bridge, Felix gets the sort of heads up that Sanchez, this drug lord who he's been after for years, is suddenly in play and ready to be arrested. And we get this glorious scene of Bond, Felix in their wedding gear, and the DEA agents all ready to sort of take him out. Yes, I mean, this never happened on my wedding day.
No, nothing similar.
The whole aspect of that, when you've got some slow motion running, you've got...
Oh, I love that, yeah.
The gunfights, the Bond jumping out the helicopter, and the whole why Sanchez has left, because he's not a recluse as such, but he's very much confined to his sort of home city.
Yeah.
And he's left to get his girlfriend back who's cheating on him. And
this scene... I have actually thought about this scene more than any other scene in the movie. So okay. when he goes and captures Lupe or finds that she's sleeping with someone else, I always felt sorry for the dude that had his like heart cut out. You know, did he promise you his heart? Give him his heart. And I just thought, oh, that's so nasty. And he was probably just about to have his way with Lupe. But since reflecting and watching this film, I actually have no sympathy for this guy, because he's got it all wrong, what he's doing there. He's got a guy outside, right, on shag watch, who's asleep. Now, what he really needs is that guy inside. He needs that guy inside facing and watching the door whilst he's in bed, not watching the back of his eyelids, you know, with the gun out and ready. That's mistake number one. Mistake number two, he's just way too casual, right? So when they barge in and they shoot the gun by his bedside, he's just there in his weird what looks like a chamois, like those pants. And I can only assume that they haven't done the deed yet, because there's no way that you put those pants back on after sex. So he's got no rush to have this out of the way. He should be in and out, like literally and figuratively be in and out, because he's not sleeping with his best mate's sister. He is sleeping with the mistress of a Colombian drug lord. So there should be no waiting around time. The last mistake that he's made, he's got the gun beside the bed, like on the nightstand there, which he reaches for immediately, but then gets shot out of his hand. Now, the only way that he can make it out of this situation alive is if he's got the guard inside. He is doing Lupe doggy style, looking at the guard, and he has got the gun duct taped to his back, again, like Die Hard, so that if there's any intrusion, he's just ready to go. You know, he's just one arm swift away. And that's how he gets out of that situation.
I guess this is how Bond has survived so many
close
calls.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of Terry Hatcher saying, "Do you still sleep with a gun under your pillow?" It's like, no, I've moved it to the back of my shoulder. What is now sellotape survival purpose. Anyway, so look, I've actually dissected that scene in my head like countless times of how I would get out alive if I was this guy sleeping with Lupe.
But this is the whole fantasy of James Bond. It's, you know, what would we do in those situations?
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And Sanchez showing his ruthless streak by, as you say, cutting the fella's heart out, and he makes reference to it later when he says, "Did you get my Valentine?"
Oh yeah, no, yeah, that's it's really nasty. But again, you're introduced to Davi in a really like pernicious way. You can see already how filthy he is with just ordering a kill and then whipping her with, I think it's like a stingray whip, isn't it? In the book, it relates to a stingray whip.
Yeah, because I had a look at this because I had the Taschen book, and it said that in the book of, is it the Hildebrand rarity, it was a stingray tail. This was apparently supposed to be an iguana tail.
Yeah,
but it just looked like a rubber dildo of some sort. But
yeah,
I don't know how much damage that would do. Well,
like to think that is now going to make its way onto Wikipedia as well. You know, the more rumor mills around that whip is, the better.
It's important. Yeah, we've got this chase where Bond and Felix are in the helicopter, and Sanchez makes off in the plane, and they manage to winch the back of the airplane and tow it off, while Bond and Felix parachute out of the helicopter to the wedding. It's it's a pretty smooth entrance.
It is, and I actually really like this entrance. So, and what I did learn on doing some reading was that Hedison blew his knees out just jumping into shot. So you can imagine like the parachute guys who are coordinated by a guy called B.J. Worth. Ooh. Now, that's a great name. B.J. Worth, yeah. Anyway, he's in charge of all the parachuting and all the stunts that's going on down there. They have to get out of a plane, fly down, you know, and hit the spot, etc. And all Hedison has to do is jump off a stepladder that's about 2 feet up, and he's just like completely done his knees in. So, yeah, but how emasculating it must be, because Dalton was like dangling from that wire for real, right? So he's at up around 2,000 feet, what have you, dangling from this wire, getting onto the back of the plane. And here's poor old Felix. He can't get down from a stepladder without doing himself an injury.
We're recording this about a week after David Hedison passed away.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, there's a lot of love for the work he did and the fact that he was in Live and Let Die as well. I mean, it's quite strange that, and I guess we're in a world where, you know, we're on our sixth James Bond. I've lost count of how many Felix Leiters there have been, but he was in Live and Let Die, and there were Felixes in between, including the last very random one in the Living Daylights, and then we're back to David Hedison again.
But
at least he's more integral in the role this time.
I saw an interview he did on a red carpet on YouTube after he died. There's obviously a lot of press going around, and he said that he was in a restaurant with Cubby Broccoli, and they said hi to each other, and he thinks that's what triggered Cubby to go, "Oh yeah, David would be pretty good for this." So he thinks it was a chance encounter that sparked something in Cubby for him to get the invite back, which is interesting.
And it's nice for both of Dalton's Bond films. In the pre-title sequence, he's parachuted his way to safety.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. It's actually, I think the Daylights one is a stronger pre-titles, but I still like this one.
When we went to see License to Kill at the cinema last month. I mean, we didn't go together, but both screenings had an introduction from Alan Church, who worked on the film with Morris Binder. It's funny when you see the credit sequence or the title sequence for a Bond film, and especially back then, they've changed now, but they were very cliche. There were a bevy of attractive women dancing and wind machines and all sorts, but to actually see it behind the scenes, on he had some footage that had never been shown before, and the way he talked about it, it was certainly reduced the glamour from it when he was talking about sticking the actress in a paddling pool from Uxbridge Argos.
Yeah, I did like that bit. I thought he was brilliant, by the way, Alan Church. Yeah. I thought he presented that really well. I don't think it's his usual things to get up there and do public speaking, but the way he presented it was just fantastic for us nerds. And my girlfriend did laugh at a certain bit what he said, because I think this is Morris Binder's last one, right? His last pre-title sequence. And he's got like 10, 12 hours worth of footage, unforeseen footage in his attic of all these girls. And they said that this whole sequence took about 3 months to film, or something it was quite protracted and long. Like Anastasia just laughed at this bit. I said, what is it? She goes, they got this on the first take. And they got it on the first day, and then for the like 12 weeks after, they're just watching girls flying around in next to nothing.
I could think of worse jobs to do. Yeah. But I mean, bear in mind, he also talked about the length of time it took to record one of the promotional clips of Timothy Dalton spinning around with a gun, and it turned out he was just sat on a regular office chair.
Yeah. Oh, really? Jesus, I must have missed that. That's interesting. But yeah, that was really, really, really good. And that cinema as well, the Prince Charles Cinema, it just sounded amazing. So you had, when Dalton comes on in the gun barrel sequence, I mean, that music that fires in there, I mean, that's the stuff of nightmares, isn't it? It's just the... And it's... Crikey, I nearly shat myself. I've forgotten how good that gun barrel music is. It's phenomenal.
The title, or the song... for this film, it was Licensed to Kill by Gladys Knight. What are your opinions of it?
I actually have quite strong opinions on this song, Richard, because I love it. And I now, dialing it back maybe about 10 years, I was in a band called Goldfingers. I had this idea. It was me and my piano teacher. I was playing the piano as well, and we were both huge Bond fans, and I said, why don't we go to casinos and just be in the background playing Bond music? Surely casinos will love that, and people playing blackjack or Chemin de Fer will love that and dig that too. So we learned all the Bond songs, and because he's got a full head of hair and he's dark, he played the Bond version, and because I'm bald and short, I played Blofeld. So I got a Dr. Evil costume online. I bought a wheelchair for about 20 quid from this poor fella who came to the door on crutches, and you know, he was just on his, I was about to say his last legs, but that's cruel. So he had to get rid of this wheelchair. So I used that, and I'll send you the video afterwards, because it's actually the promo video is fantastic. But I remember vividly him saying that his favourite song was Licence to Kill. I thought at the time, that's nuts. It's Live and Let Die is the best Bond song of all time. There's no doubt in my mind. But since that seed of doubt almost has been put in my mind, I've really come to love Licence to Kill, the song. It's like the longest Bond song, and it really goes through the gears. It's got a fantastic C section, the kind of bridge, the breakdown. And when the key change comes in, it's unbelievable. It's balls to the wall. It's really meaty. So I really dig this, and I'd probably say it's my favourite Bond song. If not, it's definitely in my top three.
It was trying to, I suppose, take a more modern take of the Shirley Bassey themes, or that type anyway, that I suppose they've been going back to, or they went back to with Adele. But I mean, there were rumours that apparently Eric Clapton recorded a song for this as well. And I haven't heard it. Now, this is one of those, you know, you always hear these alternate takes. Now, I didn't realise there was a For Your Eyes Only alternate Blondie song, but there was also did Radiohead do one for, was it Spectre or Skyfall?
So Radiohead have done a couple. They did Man of War back in the OK Computer days. I think Man of War, whatever 90s, it would have probably been a Brosnan something or other.
Yeah.
That's on YouTube. Go listen to Man of War. That's fantastic. That is a real, you know, when Tom York wanted to play the guitar, that's absolute, really, that's a real ripper of a song. And then did a version of Spectre for Spectre. But they released that, I think, around Christmas time for free, because the gig went to Sam Smith. this is also what's great about Bond, is that everyone's got their favourite Bond, everyone's got their favourite Bond film, and then you have nuances and layers within that. What's their favourite song? And I really like Spectre by Sam Smith, but I really love Spectre by Radiohead. I think it's a far more interesting song. Whether it could have fitted and weaved into the soundtrack somehow, I think it could have done much better. Other people were just saying it's a bit of a misfire, it doesn't really go anywhere, but I think it's a very atmospheric and a real, real good song, Spectre. But,
yeah. Discussion on one of the other episodes about Tomorrow Never Dies and how that song, The Surrender, the K.D. Lang song, was weaved into the score for that film.
Yeah.
And then got bumped off the opening credits for Sheryl Crow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I suppose, like, is it in Friends, we sort of say, oh, Sheryl Crow suddenly became available. But, you know, and again, it's strange when you hear, you know, even from The Living Daylights and how the Pretenders were quite involved in that, and then A-ha popped up and had issues with John Barry.
That's right, yeah.
It's a bit of a sad thing to hear.
Yeah.
That was Barry's last outing.
Yeah. I think he had throat cancer at this point, or some kind of cancer. So yeah. They called on Michael Kamen, and he was living in London at the time and had the studio quite close by. So when they did all the sound and the post-production, etc., at Pinewood, so they did go back to Pinewood, then it was more convenient to have Kamen involved. But Kamen was like a big thing at the time. So he was doing the Lethal Weapons, the Die Hards, and Roadhouse. So he was naturally going to be a guy that was going to do a big film like this.
If you're going to do a film in that era and you can do it in that style, you try and get as many people in as possible who are used to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, after the title sequence, we go to Sanchez is in custody, facing 936 years in prison, which I always find quite amusing that a lot of American justice, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but they give you an actual total number of years. You know, they don't just say life or whatever.
They'll right.
say you'll get hundreds of years in prison for what you've done, and obviously, unless you're very, very odd, you probably won't live to see the end of that.
Yeah, I like that.
But then he offers $2 million to the DEA agent Killifer for his release.
Yeah.
I suppose this is the thing where Killifer, we meet him briefly at Felix's wedding as well. He's clearly the bribeable type. But his whole role in this setup, and it kind of shows one of the themes of Sanchez's villainy, is that he rewards loyalty.
Yeah.
Now, because Killifer has helped him escape, because that's the next scene where they drive off the bridge in Key West, and Killifer takes out the driver of the van. They have scuba gear and everything ready for Killifer as well.
Yeah.
He's helped Sanchez, so Sanchez keeps his word. So this is, again, a very slight blurring of the lines. Obviously, this guy's an evil villain.
Yeah.
But he's got some sort of moral code that most people would, if not agree with, at least think, yeah, that's understandable.
Do you know what? That's a really good point. And I think it was Robert Davi's line at some point during the film where he says, loyalty is more important to me than money. And that's when he gets really, really narked off, is when he feels like his loyalty is being betrayed. I should say. So you're right, that loyalty element is a bit juxtaposition to what a villain has, isn't it? You know, a villain is just out and out bastard, but if you have this great moral code of rewarding loyalty, it sits a bit different than any other Bond villain, doesn't it?
Well, it's something that from the Taschen book, and again, I'm not going to make myself sound like I know what I'm talking about here, but Michael G. Wilson said that they model Bond on one of Kurosawa's heroes. Again, that's about where my knowledge ends, but where the samurai comes to town and without overtly attacking the villain, sows the seeds of distrust and watches as the villain brings himself down. Now that's, again, later throughout the film, Bond ingratiates himself to Sanchez by giving him information and basically setting up these people that, so Sanchez portrays them as disloyal. And then that's kind of that setting off the madness, because it is like, you know, with Milton Crest, for example, even though Crest is, I would say, incompetent, but he certainly doesn't help himself. But Bond sets him up as, you know, he's scamming Sanchez.
Yeah.
And he makes himself trustworthy by making others appear to be untrustworthy.
So that's right. I've read somewhere the same thing too, that Michael G. Wilson themed this. I think it's Bo Jimbo or something. I remember it's got a Jimbo in it, was the original film. And then you had, I think, A Fistful of Dollars that also played on this theme, where you have a guy in the middle that rather take on two parties, two warring factions, play them off against each other. And then that goes on to License to Kill, and I believe Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis had similar themes, even though I never got past 10 minutes of that film. So yeah, that's right. And also the Milton Crest has a real bad time in this movie. He's, according to a quote by Anthony Zerb, he goes, "I'm buffeted by the slings and arrows of Bond," which means the minute that he meets Bond, his life just goes down the plug hole. I think that's quite an apt way of phrasing it.
Now, at the wedding reception, we don't know the backstory about Della at all, but she seems, I suppose she's only human, she seems very smitten with Bond.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
More so than Felix, who spends his wedding reception typing a report on the typical late 80s computer.
And that got the biggest laugh in the cinema, I think, didn't it? Or one of the biggest laughs was the sight of that huge monstrosity that was the 80s computer. Yeah. No, you're right. I think Della is very forward, isn't she? She's very very friendly with Bond.
I mean, he's the best man at the wedding and she's flirting, but I mean, it's not for me to say what's normal or not, but yeah, it's a little bit strange, isn't it?
Well, I mean,
I'm glad it wasn't me.
Yeah, I think, and it's always when Lighter's not around. You know, she always plants really big kisses on him when Lighter's in the next room or in the office. Now, I've got a reason why the dad wasn't too keen on Lighter. It was probably because he's 30 years older, for one. But so Della, I think Priscilla Barnes is her name. She was supposed to be like this crash hot dancer. She had a career that was going to go off into the stratosphere as this wonderful dancer, but she fell off a stage and broke her leg, then decided to take up acting as a plan B. She was red hot, basically, and is red hot back in the day. She was, you know, arguably too good for Edison, the likes of Edison.
But he's again, miraculously conjecture. Well paid, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
But as Bond is leaving the wedding or the reception at the end, she throws her garter to him and gives him the whole, "Oh, you know who catches this is next." And this is where Felix says he was married once.
Yeah.
Now, it's something that it has popped up in the previous film, because sometimes, you know, the fact that Bond had a wife doesn't get mentioned, and I guess, you know, why would it necessarily? But does Della not know that he was married? I mean, Bond just kind of shakes his head and no.
"You know the tradition? The next one who catches this is the next one who..."
"No. Thanks, Della. It's time I left."
"Oh, James." "Did I see something wrong?"
"He was married once."
He could have done that in a less douchey way, I think. You know, just maybe just have caught it and walked off and go, "I'll keep that to myself." But he makes a real point of it, doesn't he? No.
But then he keeps it in his pocket because, you know, he's going to probably sniff it.
Yeah. Well, why not? But yeah, it's a nice touch. Lighter tells her. So obviously it's not news that he openly broadcasts. But also gives you an insight into the relationship of Lighter and Bond, that them two know each other in and out, which really cements the revenge story in this, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Or the revenge.
And Lighter's clearly known him since he was Roger Moore.
Right. Yeah. So, and he knows. And Roger alludes to it as well, I think, in Spy, doesn't he?
Yeah, and also the opening of For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah,
it's the grave.
Of course, yeah.
I forgot to say something that's quite important. They give Bond a gift of a
genuine Felix Lighter.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and it's just nice that, you know, these gifts, it's like a gadget from Q, because they usually pop up again at some point.
They do, yeah. And so this lighter was, I believe, like the original Dunhill lighter that Dr. No... This wasn't the original one, but it was a Dunhill lighter. Now, the props department wanted to get this similar lighter with a case for later scenes in the casino. And so they phoned up Dunhill and said, "Look, is there any chance we can get a lighter that was very similar to the one used in Dr. No?" And the sales assistant who picks up the phone goes, "Huh, well, that's actually uncanny, because I've got the same lighter here. Someone was going to gift it to their husband because he was a huge Bond fan. So they got that lighter." That, as, you know, as the story goes.
Oh, nice.
By the way, I'll come up with lots of weird bits of trivia for this because it's somehow cemented in my brain, and some of it will be quite entertaining. I guess a lot of it will be superfluous. Like I know, like, most of the door handles in this film are actually the same because the props department couldn't get anything in Mexico. You'd normally hire out the furniture in England, but in Mexico you can't really do that. So, like, they skirted past that by just getting all the same door handles.
Cue people going back and watching this film again and watching the door handles.
Exactly. Yeah.
So as Bond has driven off, Felix and Della go back in to consummate the marriage, and there are goons and a very, very, very young Benicio del Toro.
There he is, yeah.
Don't know how old he was. Was he 21-ish when this?
He is 22.
Yeah, and a lot younger from what we're used to now. The sort of very wizened, leathery old face, but even here he's menacing.
He is, no, and he's a young man. He's such a great cast as well, because I think this was his second film. His first one was like a Pee Wee Herman film or something. And so he was a complete unknown, but he obviously had something about him. He had some great charisma, and Cubby really liked him. So yeah, and often you see Benicio del Toro in other films, and I sometimes forget that he's actually a Bond villain, and a really good one as well. He's got this like snakeish eyes. I mean, Dalton often gets to refer to as having these wolfish eyes.
Del Toro's I mean, we see it shortly afterwards. He has his own kind of little phrase, I suppose, because we're going to assume that Della was raped before she was murdered.
Yes. wait. Probably. Who knows?
We'll make the assumption, and then shot in the chest, which not a good way to go. But apparently that was one of the things I don't know if they filmed it, but it was. I looked at the British Board of Film Classification parts for this because they were quite close to rating it as an 18. And bear in mind, this was the summer that Batman came out, and I think in this country anyway, it was the first film to get a 12.
Mm.
And they were talking about some of the scenes in here about woman getting shot in the chest and how the whole thing was completely ridiculous and some of the things that they had to cut. Now, I wonder if these were actually filmed and presented to them, so they must be lurking around somewhere.
That is fascinating. I actually think that this film would have been better being an 18, because like places like this, especially with the shark later on, it does pull its punches a bit to try and get that 15 certificate. But an 18 version of this film would have really upped the ante, because it does sit on its own, this film. You know, Daylights has very Bondian things going on, you know, very arcing Fleming themes, but License to Kill protrudes a bit, and the lack of style of Dalton and being on the rogue mission. If it was an 18, it would have been a much more brutal and interesting watch, perhaps, but it would have been forgiven for being an 18 because of how isolated it is.
So, I mean, this they had six examiners watch the film, and some of them have made reference to, for me, this would be an 18 uncut. Right. And then they've mentioned pre-cut versions and stuff. So, I mean, these extra scenes, and I suppose they're just the odd second here and there. They talk about Sanchez beating Lupe, Lighter being fed to the shark, and Dario in the grinder, using the app, but the thing. And you do wonder, because I know, you know, people after some of the podcasts have done have then sent me YouTube links and stuff. Now, we're talking about when Roger Moore was in prison in A View to a Kill. No, I know Marty mentioned it, but I didn't actually realise it was on YouTube. And there was the scene with the magic carpet from The Living Daylights.
Yeah,
and again, I didn't realise that actually existed. So hopefully if anyone listens to this and knows where these extra bits can be found, send them my way.
Those were really good, the outtakes. And when he's telling Stacey that guy can fuck off, what does he know? That's just pure Bond. But that's interesting, because there is, when you said that they must have shot her in the chest, or a woman gets shot in the chest, I know that they filmed this scene first before the wedding.
Right.
Because they needed to go out and get a second wedding dress, because the first one's all covered in blood and whatnot. So there was a big hoo-ha about getting an exact same dress, and it cost a lot of money, apparently. So there would have been some deterioration on the dress. Mm. So it's a good shout. She probably was shot, and that probably was filmed.
I suppose they didn't have Mexican TK Maxx in the late 80s.
No, it wasn't a thing back then.
No. But we get to Crest's warehouse, and this is where Lighter gets, well, not killed, but he gets fed to the shark. And this is the thing I noticed in a previous episode, where sharks are still the kind of great enemy. Mm. We're kind of, 14, 15 years after Jaws?
Yeah.
and we're still looking at sharks as this ultimate killing machine. Now, I mean, I don't know a huge amount about sharks, but I'm amazed Leiter survived.
Well, that is interesting. And so this shark scene, Robert Darby says that there was a lot of this cut, and even Hedison's wife hated this scene when they saw it. So she kind of, I don't know if she walked out, but she was really anti this because of how gory it was. But Robert Darby's like, well, what are we doing here? You know, Jaws came out 15 years ago and we're still hung up on this. He likes the scene. He likes the idea of the shark, but he thought that some of the footage should have stayed in. Now, there is a bit. So you're right with him like lowering him down, and at the end he kind of, after he goes, go to hell, see you in hell, he does a little wind up motion as to say, like, wind him up. So I think it was his intention to lower him down, and he says, look, this is the first day of the rest of your life. It was only supposed to wound him and maybe like bite off a leg or so, and to keep him alive. But, you know, the old me, before, you know, seeing this film a bunch of times, assumed that he was just going to kill him just by lowering him down, and that was the intention.
Obviously, when Bond goes to the airport, and again, this is what he said about how he has limited access to clothes because he only has a suitcase and a briefcase, and he runs back from the airport to the house. This is where he shouts, Della!
Della!
And finds Felix sort of wrapped up on the sofa with the sign, the handwritten sign.
He, what was it? He disagreed with something that ate him.
Yeah.
Well, which is from Live and Let Die, isn't it? That's Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
Fleming. And then he goes throughout the rest of the novels with a hook and a spare leg or something. But no, it's actually, I really love that line. I mean, obviously it was a Fleming line, but it's a really cool little note to leave if you are going to do something that dastardly. Nice play on words.
So Felix gets taken to hospital. Bond realises that the Americans don't really have a lot. Sounds awful, but a lot of interest in catching Sanchez because he's back in Isthmus and there's no extradition, and Grandel Bush, or the other Special Agent Johnson, makes regular references to let us do our job and this.
Yeah.
I do like something that, though, he does refer to Bond as Commander.
Yeah, no, that is good.
And I like that touch because, again, it doesn't get mentioned a huge amount that Bond was a naval commander. He's, you know, as an intelligence officer, it's nice that people still respect his rank.
Yeah, no, exactly. And also when Robert Brown calls him good luck, Commander, or no, God help you, Commander, when he goes to Hemingway House, that's another nice little touch. Commander is such a sexy rank.
Yeah, it's just a shame we didn't see him in his naval uniform.
I know. Well, at some point we'll probably get onto the fashion of this film, but apparently Jodie Tillon, the costume designer, wanted to put Bond in all these pastel colours because he's out there in Key West. You know, this would be what he wears naturally in Key West. But Dalton said, no. He's from a naval background. He'll be wearing blues and dark blues. So, yeah, whatever you say about the style and the fashion of this film, at least Dalton wasn't walking around in orchid shirts and whatnot.
That would be amusing. After you know, the interview that was in Everything or Nothing, where he was saying about how the earlier Bond films were becoming a parody and he was this cold-blooded killer. You can imagine a cold-blooded killer in Bermuda shorts.
There was a scene that was actually really good of him on a boat, but they had to cut it because he was wearing this weird hat, like this fisherman's hat, apparently. I've not seen it, but I have listened to the JBR podcast about this, and they highlighted that one.
Bond and Sharky, who not mentioned yet, but they go off looking at all the various sort of marine warehouses, and because Sharky's obviously clearly knows that it was a shark that took off Leiter's leg. And this is Bond with the Universal Exports claiming to be interested in a... Now, it's going to sound lame, me saying it, because he carries it off so well, but it's a Carcharodon Carcharodis.
Carcharodon Carcharodis.
Carcharodon Carcharodis.
Yeah.
I mean, I have that locked in, the Latin name for a great white shark, which is wrong on Wikipedia, by the way. They call it a tiger shark. It's not. It's a Carcharodon Carcharodis is a great white. Now, that I have embedded in my brain because of Richard Dreyfuss saying it so many times in Jaws. You know, when he's trying to appeal to the guy who's shutting down the beach, he's like, it's a Carcharodon Carcharodis. It's a great white. You know, so, it's nice that he knows the Latin phrase for this. I think Bond would do.
Well, and he's probably seen Jaws.
He's probably seen Jaws. Yeah, it's been 15 years since Jaws.
On an in-flight movie somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, to Key West.
So Bond meets Crest, and it's all very unamicable, but he breaks back in later on, finds a load of, was it 500 kilograms of cocaine in there, in the maggots, and then and bumps into Killifer, who's still loitering at the warehouse waiting for his pickup.
Yep.
And this is where he gets his revenge.
Oh,
the guy
yeah.
who betrayed Felix.
Oh, Killifer, he looks, I've written it down here, but he looks like the guy who set fire to the Christmas tree in Lampoon's Vacation. And I wanted to look him up now to see how he's changed. And he's morphed more into that older dude. He's a great character, though, Killifer. He's like, hey, old buddy, and all that. It reminded me of the throwback to from Russia with Love, when Red Grant calls Bond old man, etc. And then, you know, Connery gives him the old man dead talk, you know, when he kills him.
Yeah.
And he does this to Killifer. He, like, throws the case back and you keep it, old buddy. So he gets hoist by his own petard, which is quite nice.
And then Dalton's face, Sharky, so he throws a suitcase of $2 million at him.
Yeah.
And Sharky says, what a waste. Dalton sort of gives him this utter evil, and he goes, of money.
What a terrible waste of money.
Yeah, that's nice. And I like the fact that, so when Hedison gets lowered into the shark pool, Darby doesn't look away, but Killifer does. So Killifer winces, you know, he doesn't like to see this. And it's the same with this scene in a way, that Dalton doesn't wince, you know, he doesn't blink. So they've got that same gene of ruthlessness.
It's nice to see, I suppose, it's that common bond between, you know, the villain and Bond.
Yeah.
They're not so different, you and I.
Exactly. They have to have some kind of symmetry. They both like seeing people get eaten by sharks. Is my take on.
Or they could equally be fans of Jaws 3.
Yeah, why not? Jaws 3. Jeez.
Great film. Now, Bond is summoned to Hemingway's house, where M just happens to be, and he gets his license revoked, which was almost the title of this film.
Yeah.
And, I wasn't sure. I heard that they took that off because it's one of these, I don't know whether it's become a sort of urban tale that it would have confused Americans.
No,
because
that's
true. The term when their sort of driving license gets taken off them.
That's true, yeah. And it was all driving license related. They thought, well, what's all this about? And, you know, people have a joke about the Americans. They go, look, we couldn't have King George IV or whatever it was, because they would think there was three films before that. You know, there's other films out there where they substituted a complicated or convoluted name and made it a bit more simple for the Americans. But then if they didn't have that filter, then you just get titles like Quantum of Solace, which everyone just looks at each other and goes, I still don't know what that means.
But we did joke about this on the Death Wish 3. It was actually the number 3 rather than Roman numerals, because they said that people would have thought it was Death Wish 111. I mean, again, that was a canon film, so maybe that was just their logic. But
I like that. That's good.
But yeah, so Bond has been de-double-O'd, I suppose. And again, this is, I wonder if this was a Dalton thing where he said, like, a farewell to arms.
Yeah, I like
being
that.
A Hemingway quote. But and then this is where, I suppose, he goes rogue 10, 15 years before it becomes the common thing in Bond films.
Yeah, I know, and perhaps a bit too common. Can I talk about the Hemingway house real quick?
Yeah, go on.
So this is one location that if anyone's going to Key West or have been to Key West, they'll know this Hemingway house. It doesn't have the plaque on front of the wall like it does in the film. Before they go in, you can see Hemingway house. I don't know if that was a prop for the film, perhaps it was. But the actual house is fantastic and is probably the best thing about Key West, one of the best visitors attraction that's worth the hype. So you have about 40 to 50 cats. Half of them have 6 toes, but all of them have the polydactyl gene. So they're all descendants from Hemingway's cat, which was Snow White, I think. And these cats, right, these cats get absolutely spoiled rotten. They're treated like royalty. So they get their own vet visits once a week. They have their own cat fountains. They've got gluten-free cat kibble. They're personal trainers. I mean, they have got the lot, and they have got the absolute run of the place. So you'll have parts of the house that are fenced off that you're not allowed to see. For example, the carriage house, which is like a little tiny house that Hemingway had aside where he wrote most or half of the canon for his books. So you can see inside the studio, see the typewriter, whatnot, but it's barred off, so you can't go in. Whereas these cats can weave in and out of the bars and, you know, jump onto the desk, wipe their nutsack on the typewriter. They can literally do what the F they want. Hemingway himself. Now, I've tried reading a couple of Hemingway books. I've got a some way into them, but, you know, I'm by no means a Hemingway reader. Now, he's got a real, real nutty life. Do you know much about Hemingway at all, Rich?
Not a huge amount, no.
So he had two plane crashes. He survived two plane crashes. Blimey. One of the planes hit like an abandoned pole, and him and his wife, Mary, you know, survived that, but he was injured. And the next day he was going to get flown to a hospital, and that plane exploded on the tarmac. God. And it's just a succession of real bad luck stories. So, you know, he got wounded in the war. He had so many concussions, car crashes, broke his arm a bunch of times in car crashes. I mean, he was in a lot of agony towards the end of his life, which was probably one of the reasons why he ultimately killed himself. But yeah, a real interesting life. Now, I don't know if any of your listeners can perhaps clarify this, but one of the reasons why there's not been a dedicated film or biography of his life is because I think the family don't want that, or he asked not to have a film made about his life. I know there's a Wrestling with Hemingway documentary out there, but there's no Ryan Gosling does Hemingway, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I suppose the closest we get is Mariel Hemingway in Superman 4.
Well, that is a reach. I mean, I was going to mention that myself, but I thought it would perhaps be lost.
Wasn't she was his granddaughter, I believe, or something like that. That's about as far as I can
This
remember.
Is out of my jurisdiction, as guy would say. But anyway, sorry to go on with very prolonged version of
Finally,
Hemingway.
A bit of culture.
But a real fascinating history, and a great place to visit if you're in Key West.
So we arrive on Crest's boat again. Lupe's on board. Crest is giving her a bit of a hard time. Now, Bond sneaks on dressed as a manta ray, and then this is when his sort of plot to take the revenge on Sanchez comes in, because he starts cutting up all the drugs in the water. And if he'd planned this out, he probably wouldn't have planned it as well.
I know, right? Yeah. No.
And he manages to both destroy however many kilos of drugs were in there and swim around in water that's completely full of cocaine.
Yeah.
And then one of my favourite stunts of a Bond film, as he's being attacked underwater, shoots a harpoon to a seaplane which is about to take off and water skis off the back of it.
For me, this is the best set piece of the movie. I know we've got the truck scene that we'll get to at the end of the finale, but I think this, when he emerges from the water and he's barefoot skiing, the music that kicks in, it's finally like, oh, you're out of the realms of Lethal Weapon. You're out of the realms of Roadhouse. You're absolutely permanently planted in a Bond film. And it's a phenomenal stunt. So the guy, Dave Reinhardt, he was like this world champion barefoot skier, and he could do it from a standing start. So he could be on land and the boat would ping off and he'd be able to plant himself and actually water ski barefoot without having any skis to start with. So, you know, he was phenomenal. And then it was Jake Lombard who hung on to the pontoon. So once he's then on the plane, you switch to another stunt guy. Now, he was like really heavily bruised, apparently, because, you know, you're just taking off, but you're dangling on the side of this plane. Oh. Your legs are kind of ricocheting across the water about 80-90 miles an hour. So, you know, he was proper hurt on this. But that is still a fantastic stunt. Nowadays, you have Tom Cruise hanging on the side of a plane as they take off. So you have to put things in perspective of how great a stunt is. I mean, it's still a fantastic stunt. Dalton was doing that, and you had like a first-person camera on Dalton going up in the air. That would be next level.
You know, some of the promotion, and I know even John Glenn mentioned it in one of the books I read, that he hated the fact that this film didn't do very well. And he partly blamed the promotion side of it, saying that, you know, we're out at the same time as Batman and Lethal Weapon 2.
Mm.
And yet the only promotion he saw for License to Kill was on the side of bus stops.
Modest.
You know, the trailers, I mean, it's the same with a lot of the Bond films at the time. The trailers were either far too long and gave away far too much, or they were a bit too vague. And, you know, when you're at a time of the late, and I mean, Batman, that whole Batman film was such a phenomenon in many ways, but one of them was the marketing.
Mm.
And when you put a Bond film, this Bond film, which, you know, and I think time has been very kind to this Bond film.
Yeah,
and Dalton's reign in particular.
Apart from the computers, maybe.
Well, nothing like technology to age a film. But this Bond film and The Living Daylights and Dalton's Reign seem to be looked on more fondly these days than perhaps they were at the time. But this film was up against Batman.
Yeah.
And, you know, even as a 9-year-old growing up, you know, Batman was everywhere.
Yeah. No, that is true.
And, I mean, I wasn't massively aware of Lethal Weapon or anything like that. And I knew License to Kill was out because I couldn't go and see it.
Right.
But Batman, my God. That summer, everything was Batman.
It was, yeah. And I vividly remember now. I haven't done my research that much. I knew that Batman and License to Kill was the same year. So that's interesting because I thought that it was Batman that was the very first 12.
It was.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I was underage then as well, and there was this huge queue around the block for the huge cinema in Bedford at the time. I think it was like the Grand. Oh, the names escaped me, but it was one of the biggest cinemas in the country. It's now like a parking lot. But I remember queuing up around the block for Batman and just being beyond excited to see Batman. And Bond was just somewhere in the distance, not even really on my radar for something to see at cinema. So that was the phenomenon that was Batman at the time. It overtook Bond, definitely.
I think, you know, partly people are doing more research now and that. But one of the reasons why this was the last Bond film for 6 years, that, you know, people were saying, oh, because it did so bad at the box office. But people, again, now are realising that that wasn't the reason. There were so many legal issues going on. There was supposed to be a third Dalton Bond film in 1991-92.
Mm.
And I, again, mentioned it before, but imagine having seen, you know, a third Dalton Bond film set around the time of the end of the Cold War and the end of era of communism.
Yeah.
No. And it was nothing to do with the poor box office that this got. I mean, it would have probably made some changes, but yeah, I think we've been denied.
Yeah, I didn't think it did. That's interesting, because I think it still made money, right? The Bond film made money, but it just didn't do as well as other Bond films. So is that what you're saying about reflection of the box office?
The books I saw were that it was adjusting for inflation, it had the poorest return
of a
Bond film at that point.
Okay, so. All right, well, that makes sense. I mean, they really strimmed back on the cost of this Bond film. So I think it was like, again, I'm pulling numbers out of the sky. Let's just say I think it was $35 million to make this Bond film.
Was the joke that that little annoying weedy cunt.
Truman Lodge.
You know who I mean. He made the joke in the warehouse that the whole setup for the factory for the cocaine was $32 million because that was the budget of the film.
Okay, great. No, that's I like that one. So that was the budget for the film. And at the time, I think you had Indiana Jones running off at about $50 million. Other films around the time were coming out more expensive, so they moved away from Pinewood to do everything in Mexico to make it cheaper. And eventually it goes, yeah, it worked, because we can look at these other films and they were about 15-20 million more. But they said that they had to burn twice as many calories, work twice as many hours, and, you know, every scene has the same doorknob, so you can probably factor in that it was a real ball ache to get hold of a lot of the props and the furniture and do the logistics out in Mexico. Had it been in Pinewood, everything would have been a bit more run of the mill, I guess, but more expensive.
But as you mentioned Indiana Jones, I completely forgot, because that The Last Crusade came out that year as well.
Right, okay, yeah.
You know, and you kind of think, you know,
and you got a Bond in that, right?
So exactly. Yeah. And there was, I don't know how it would have worked, but there was talk that Pushkin would have popped up in this film, but then he was off playing Salah,
yeah, yeah.
In that, but it's just, I mean, I suppose I haven't done a podcast about Batman or Indiana Jones yet, so, but I mean, that summer was huge,
yeah,
and you can see why a Bond film that wasn't following the traditional route would suffer.
So, Rich, getting on to that then, slight aside, what are you going to do about 90s films? Do you adjust the name of the podcast, or do you release a different one? I mean, once you've expunged all of the 80s films that everyone likes and talks about.
Well, I did make a reference once that I should do a Laserdisc video club. But then someone suggested that, well, actually, Laserdisc were invented in the 70s.
There's always some clever fucker. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, at the moment, I was going to be purely capitalist and put them on Patreon. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's a lot of gold to be mined. I haven't even done Police Academy yet. I mean, what was this?
Okay. Well, great. I mean, we've got so many to look forward to.
So Bond flies off in this plane, having destroyed numerous amounts of drugs and throw some of the money around, but he keeps, and I think they worked out it is $4.9 million,
mm-hmm. yeah,
of the money that was in the plane, and this is where he starts using it wisely. He's managed to get Pam Bouvier's details from Felix's ancient computer.
Yeah,
meets her at the Barrelhead bar that we discussed earlier.
Right.
Now, when I saw the screening of the film, this scene got probably some of the biggest laughs.
Yeah.
Because Pam and Bond meet Dario, Del Toro's character, and it ends up in this massive bar fight that can only be described as like something out of Blazing Saddles.
Yeah. Or Convoy. something where a punch is thrown at one end of the bar and the domino effect of it rippling through the entire bar. Yeah, it's... I miss those kind of bar fights in movies where people just get involved. It's almost like everyone's on the starting blocks to throw a headbutt, aren't they? And they just need something to kick off 20 or 30 feet away from them. And that's it, it's game on.
It's the closest we get to a Western.
Yeah, exactly. So what did you think of this scene in relation, really, to the movie? So, for example, the music is quite famous as well.
Well, this is it. Was this the Dirty Love?
Yeah, the Dirty Love.
What a song.
Did you catch what the barman was wearing when Dalton comes in?
No.
You can't go back and look at that.
Oh, no.
I mean, it's the most ridiculous 80s lycra vest. I mean, he's obviously put some time in at the gym, so he's showing off the muscles, but
yeah.
It's full mullet, it's full lycra. It's just unbelievable.
I suppose this is maybe the Roadhouse thing they were going for, but
yeah,
it was. I did find it funny, and I don't know whether that was the angle of maybe coming back to it 30 years later, but it was amusing. The barmaid clearly has a thing for Bond, and Pam immediately gets a back up about it, which is a recurring theme throughout the film as well.
Yeah, sure thing, hon. I like it when he slams the guy's head on the table and goes, he's had enough, put it on the tab. I don't know if this was scripted, but she didn't really have anywhere to go to leave the scene. You know, she obviously has to exit, but I think because the guy's kind of sprawled out in this unnatural way, she has to kind of hurdle over this guy, and it looks great because it looks natural, but I can't believe that was scripted for her to leap over the guy like that.
I just kind of go,
okay, got it. Now, how did Pam Bouvier get that shotgun in the bar?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that doesn't seem like the sort of bar that would have security.
But, I mean, she's not wearing, like, a trench coat or anything. Maybe she is. Maybe she hung it up.
I mean, bear in mind her penchant for tucking guns inside her leg. I don't think that shotgun would have fit.
She's walking in with that shotgun gaffer tape to her leg. I like that. I'd like to think that she probably found it under the table.
Probably left there by the previous patron.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's what it is. It's like the Weatherspoons in Kingston.
It's uncanny.
Yeah, they managed to escape by Bond shooting a hole. Oh, they shoot a hole in the wall, jump off in the boat that Bond had left. Pam gets shot in the back, that's wearing a bulletproof vest.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've only met 10, 15 minutes before, but by the time they run out of fuel, conveniently, they have a bit of a lover's tiff in the boat. Smooth.
I forget the line that he says, why don't you wait until you're asked? Well, they're haggling over a price, aren't they?
Yeah, because he's going up to Sanchez, and then she's trying to negotiate getting payment to help him out.
It seems like a weird bit of dialogue to get horny over. 70 grand, 80 grand, 30%, 40%, and then like, well, crikey, all this hot percentage talk and all this haggling is getting me turned on.
Oh, you must have hit the fuel line.
Bloody lucky to be alive.
But this was, I mean, that part was, you could see that was more out of a Roger Moore film, perhaps.
Yeah.
But there was something I saw that apparently the film was reluctant to show as much sex because of the AIDS thing that was going on at the time. And apparently Timothy Dalton confirmed this in an interview a few years ago.
Really? Well, maybe that's why the guy at the beginning, he's not doing it doggy style with Lupe. You know, he's probably fumbling around for a condom on the side of the nightstand there, and that's what's done him.
He's practicing safe sex by wearing a pair of really tight pants.
Yeah, so like safe sex is... Yeah, those pants. I've got a photo still of those pants. I might just get it.
God.
I tell you what, if Oliver Brown want to do any more 007 replica collections, then those pants, crikey, they'll fetch a small price.
Yeah, if they'd like to send a Roger Moore jacket, by the way, I'm still interested. Medium.
It's beautiful.
Medium. And this is the part with the honk on the steering wheel, and I think when I saw that at the cinema, that kind of got a few groans.
Did it? Yeah.
Honk, honk.
But it's one of the necessary crutches, isn't it? They have to form a bond, you know, intended. Not intended, actually. But they have to get that unified, look, let's shag. And also the camera pans out and they almost going downstairs. So it does, you know, it does allude to that they're definitely going to do it. Which I think is...
So here we are at Isthmus City.
Yes.
It's difficult to save you, Chris Eubank. This is supposed to be Panama, I think, pretty much, isn't it? I think it's one of those I alluded to before where it's somewhere that they've made up purely to probably avoid annoying too many people.
Yeah.
But again, it's just filmed in Mexico.
Now, so when I watched some of the JBR footage and talks about this, the isthmus is an actual thing. It's like two passages or seas of water that trap an island, which is what Panama is. So there is a bit more connotation to the word isthmus than there is to San Monique, I think, which was Fleming relating to the wherever it was, Jamaica in Live and Let Die.
Bond and Pam check into the very posh hotel and Bond giving it the whole, oh, it's adequate.
And I like that.
There's one joke, because he refers to Pam as his executive secretary.
Executive secretary, yeah.
When she suggests why can't he be her executive secretary, he laughs. This scoff of kind of, you'd never be able to get away with that now.
Yeah.
But in the 80s, that was kind of a man doing his dad job.
It's a man's world. We're south of the border. I actually fist pumped at that moment. I was like, yeah, it is. It's a man's world south of the border. I liked it. And also I liked that he just gets a little sweaty wad of cash out, leafs off a few notes, doesn't he, and gives it to the owner or the concierge and just says, fresh flowers every day. Now, I wrote in my notes, that is the pinnacle of flash bastardry. If you ever do that in a hotel when you check in, you know, just peel off a couple of 50s, fresh flowers every day.
Like, fresh flowers in my travel lodge.
Yeah, caviar.
But then that's exactly what they do in Dumb and Dumber, isn't it? And Bond goes to the bank with, I suppose it's that typical sleazy bank of, I've come to make a small deposit. We can do that downstairs, and turns up with a suitcase. Welcome to Isthmus.
Yeah, I like that. And the girl next to him's turned on as well with all this money.
Look at this handsome man with $5 million.
Yeah, that's quite cool. And then they have to count it all out whilst he's just getting on it, right?
Because has he told Pam to go and glam up or something like that?
Yeah, get some decent clothes, woman.
Get yourself a nice frock.
Yeah, which is almost a bit ironic that Dalton says that in this film. He could have probably joined her on that shopping spree and got himself suited up, but there you go.
He's obviously got his tux from somewhere at least.
Yeah, he's hired it from the bank manager maybe.
Yeah, but this is where, and again, this is because Carrie Lowell was a model, and she'd been wearing a wig beforehand apparently, and this is her glamming up and Dalton giving her a full on double take, you know, full Moonraker pigeon.
Yeah, full Moonraker pigeon.
And I did make a joke that made me sound like probably a horrible sexist on when I talked about this with Terry, but she was stunning.
She was fantastic. Yeah. No, well, she was beautiful. Again, listening to the commentary, they had everyone on set was just completely infatuated with Carrie Lowell. I mean, she doesn't really look. That's probably going to come out wrong. Doesn't look amazing to the layman. I mean, but in real life, they said this girl was the absolute nails. And I think you can see that. Now, there is a theory going around with women and short hair that if you're incredibly, incredibly hot, you try and subtract those good looks by cutting your hair really short, because women are fed up with being cold hot all the time. So they try and cut their hair and think, well, maybe you'll take me seriously now that I'm not so hot anymore. But she looks so much better with her hair like that, and I think she just looks an absolute knockout. Apparently the clapper boy, you know, he couldn't even get his shit together to do the clap between takes, because, you know, he was just infatuated with her.
I mean, she was married to Richard Gere for some time, so
really I have no idea,
but she must have some sort of gerbil features.
Well, that's another podcast.
That's another lawsuit coming my way.
Yeah.
Now, Bond, because he's Mr. High Roller Big Bollocks, rocks up at the casino and just cleaning up. I think at one point they mentioned he's up, sort of, was it $250,000 or something like that?
Yeah.
All the while Sanchez is upstairs sort of plotting the next move of his evil empire and sends Lupe down to deal. Now, she's clearly the sort of the lucky charm for him, and Bond immediately decides to cut his losses.
Yeah, exactly. No, he gets out there pretty quick. I do like the way Bond, I think when he's in the casino, this is where he's got his true swagger. So he's very blunt. He's very one line. You know, go get me a drink. Blackjack, one table. He's very economical with his words because he's there on a mission, and he's there and he's very focused, and he needs to get to Sanchez's office. So that bit, I really like it when he actually comes into the casino. I think this is a very strong moment, apart from, you know, the much pilloried hairstyle. You know, that's who signed off on that? I have no idea, but it was a real moment in the film, I think. And it's often in a lot of the Bond films, when he does go into the casino, he finds his rhythm. Doesn't he? So I really like this bit.
It does seem to be that that's his natural home.
Yeah.
And again, throughout the film, he's either, you know, pretending to be something he's not, or trying to be covert. But in this, he's playing a role. He's playing a character of, I'm multi-millionaire, give me what I want. Flash it.
No, he's brilliant in this scene. I think this is probably Dalton's strongest scene, one of them in the movie, is when he's portraying Bond in his element. And so can we talk a bit about Robert Davi?
Yeah.
For a minute. So he's upstairs, obviously, and he's got his iguana like perched on his on his shoulder. Now, I think Robert Davi is one of the best and one of the strongest Bond villains that we've seen. He doesn't have to have like any weird limb or some kind of scar, but he has that natural acne scars, like obviously from his youth. So he has this real reptilian quality, I think. You know, pair that with an iguana, which, you know, it's just a really cool combination, isn't it? He's dressed really well. And I think a lot, like at the time, the villains were dressed really well in other films as well. Like you had Hans Gruber and Die Hard, etc. And you would look to the villain to be one of the best dressed. And he's a lot better dressed than Bond throughout this film. I would actually put Robert Davi up with, say, Louis Jourdan from Octopussy as one of the best and strongest villains, because he's very cocksure. You know, he's very animalistic, but he doesn't have to have any of the tropes that perhaps a lot of the other villains were saddled with throughout the Bond franchise.
No, and I think that's kind of a movement that seems to be going through film at the moment, where they're trying to remove the portrayal of villains as having a deformity of some sort.
I think BFI have banned it. There is a production company that have banned, you know, having villains with scars, because, you know, it's a little bit unfair, isn't it, if you've got a scar or some kind of handicap to have you cast as something menacing.
Exactly. And I mean, Blofeld, even in the last Bond film, he earned his injury. And I don't know if, you know, there's rumours he'll be popping up in the next Bond film at some point. But Sanchez is, you know, he is that villain, and kind of gets ignored a little bit because he is a drug lord and he isn't this megalomaniac. You know, I mean, I always loved Drax from Moonraker.
Yeah, I love Drax.
And for me, he was the strongest part of that film. I mean, I love Moonraker, but he was such a great villain. And I've joked about if he'd been in The Spy Who Loved Me, that would have tipped that film to a 10 out of 10.
Right, okay.
Not that it really needed it. But again, another thing that Davi perhaps... is his portrayal of Sanchez is getting a little bit more love these days, because people are going back and exploring these films in a bit more detail.
That's right, yeah. And he's a bit maniacal now online, more so than he is in the film, because you know, he just sits by his pool and does political rants on Twitter, which are quite amusing. But he's clearly gone out there on a bit of a tangent. And also, just as an aside, there is a blog out there called Acne Stars with acnestars.blog, I think it is. Actors with Acne Stars. There's an actual blog and there's a whole full profile on Robert Davi. So, it's quite fascinating reading up on the dude. But anyway.
Imagine having that much of a niche.
that blog
is spectacular.
I think, yeah, I mean, imagine all of the creams that you'll be sent in the post, you know, all the freebies, and also all of the acne stars, Hollywood stars, that you'll get to interview. I don't mean to derail you again, but can I just mention so when Bond goes up to meet Sanchez?
Oh, yeah.
That is my favourite line of the movie, where he's, you know, he's problem solver, more of a problem eliminator. I just think that is a phenomenal, I think they call it a zinger in the movies, and that's the best line of this movie. And how they all kind of laugh along with it, and Dalton's laugh. And it's just really, you know, it just really sets Dalton apart as well, doesn't it? So he can deliver a line like that, more of a problem. It's so sexy.
In my business, you prepare for the unexpected.
And what business is that?
I help people with problems.
Problem solver?
I'm more of a problem eliminator.
The atmosphere in that room when he says, "Oh, you're looking for a job with me," and he kind of looks around and says, "The competition can't," you know, and he's looking at Heller and the other goon, and it's kind of like, "Yeah, you are nothing."
Yeah, exactly. He could absolutely muscle these dudes out.
Back to the hotel, and Bond's uncle is waiting for him, and we get the cool bit of Bond is taking Pam's gun off her in the lift.
Yeah,
just an excuse for her to show a bit of leg, and Bond almost breaks Q's arm.
Really, 007?
Q, what the hell are you doing here? I might have killed you.
But he's turned up on his annual leave with his bag of tricks. And the gadgets are now, of course, like in most Bond films, every gadget that he brings gets used in some way or another. But he's got this explosive alarm clock that looks like it's about 30 years old, saying guaranteed never to wake up anyone who uses it.
Yeah, I like that. And yeah, I noticed that. It is the oldest alarm clock that you'd get from a car boot sale somewhere, right?
And imagine, you know, you've brought that on holiday with you.
Yeah, it's a bit obvious. But that also, when we saw that at the Prince Charles Cinema, that got the biggest laughs as well. You know, people just love it when Q's on screen. I mean, my girlfriend was just in fits of laughter when he opened up that briefcase.
I mean, this was nice in a way because this was Q's biggest role, really. Forgetting the fact that he's also a major in the military. He's still working, he's still involved, and he's actually out and about. Now, whether because we'd had an earlier scene where Moneypenny had called Q, presumably to let him know where Bond was.
Mm.
But it was nice to see Q after, 27 years of Bond films, you know, other than You Only Live Twice and he managed to make it out with Little Nelly.
Mm.
But he's actually made it out and become an integral part of the plot.
This is his longest time in a Bond film, and he really loves being out there. And he says that he loved being in this film in particular, didn't he?
They have this very odd relationship where it is kind of that uncle, you know, he's their uncle sort of constantly chastising Bond and quite frequently comes across watching him have sex.
Do you think that was the undercurrent of the mission, that he was for other purposes?
That's why he has to share a bedroom with him. And Bond's saying, "I hope you don't snore."
He's like, "Oh, well, I hope you put out."
This is what I'm used to.
Yeah. So can I talk about like the pace of the movie, like during this bit? So you had Bond going to the bank. You had him going to the casino. He's doing the Q bit here. And now he has to sneak in and kill Sanchez from afar, right? You have Sanchez there doing the presentation to the Japanese investors and whatnot. And I think because there's so much exposition going on throughout this segment, throughout these pieces, they could have done with something like Sanchez having a more elaborate presentation. So like you have Goldfinger, for example, with the revolving tables. Zorin has like this miniature of a Silicon Valley coming through this collapsible centerpiece. I think that the film could have benefited from having something here where Sanchez was a bit more ostentatious or a bit more flamboyant with, you know, reeling the Japanese investors in. What do you think?
We did kind of think that, but then we get to the part with the laboratory and the meditation area where that essentially is an underground lair where, you know, the floor opens up to allow a helicopter in. And I think that kind of almost covers that base for me. I think while it's not the glamorous sort of thing that you'd expect from a sort of traditional Blofeld type villain, I think the fact that he does have this lair that's masquerading as something else.
Yeah, no, the lair is brilliant. I really love that. And that kind of foreground miniature, I know we're skipping ahead here, but the foreground miniature that comes up and the helicopter disappears beneath this dome. Yeah, I really dig all that. I think that's fantastic. I just think at this point, after watching it a few times, I've noticed there's, as much as I like these scenes individually and on their own, put together, it does feel, because it's all in the same night as well. It does feel like there could have been something that brought it forward a bit quicker. But anyway, that's just me.
Well, yeah, because then, you know, Sanchez meets the Japanese businessman. We're skipping from then Bond sneaking up in the building opposite as well with the signature gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, even while he's sort of sniping him out, you know, we've got Pam meeting with Heller, and we find out later that she's trying to get him to hand over these Stinger missiles.
Yeah.
We get El Presidente moaning about his check.
Yeah.
And I love the line of well, you're only a president for life.
Yeah, just a reminder that you're under my thumb, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, you were very quiet when I was in prison.
That's that. Yeah, that's I love that bit. That's really cool. I also like the bit where, you know, the presentation's over and they open up the doors and then you've got all of these ladies in the other room waiting for them. I don't know if you'd be able to get away with that scene now in today's world. Would it be... You'd have to have, like, a selection for everyone. Girls... transgenders, bi-curious, small boys. You just have to have a... You'd have to make up all the numbers in that room, wouldn't you?
I think that's something that's a bit weird. It's like, it's kind of, right, how do we distract these Japanese businessmen? Prostitutes.
Yeah, and that's quite stereotypical, I think, for these guys.
Yeah, it probably would work, but still, it just seems a bit like, here's a room of prostitutes. knock yourself out.
And by the way, they've been silent all this time. You never knew they were in there.
This is coked off their faces. Yeah. But we do have yet another subplot where Bond, as he's about to blow the window and shoot Sanchez, and we get the "watch the birdie, you bastard."
Yeah.
He suddenly becomes attacked by ninjas.
Watch the birdie, you bastard.
He does, yeah, he does. And so this then transports it to another area. And I think Bond gets his ass kicked quite easily in this scene. I do, you know, submit that he's not going to be up against these guys. He's outnumbered. These guys have got like Spider-Man nets, etc. But I would have liked to have seen just a few right hooks or some, you know, some kind of fight from Dalton there.
Or a headbutt.
Yeah, just, you know, a clean headbutt, something more industrial.
Now, one of the ninjas was actually the lady from the credits sequence, wasn't it? She was the model that they
really
used. Yeah.
Ah, okay. So what? She was the girl that was... like wearing
dancing in the paddling
yeah
pool.
Right, okay. She's fantastic.
Yeah But this is because it turns out that the businessman, he's annoyed that Bond has ruined their plan because he's Hong Kong police or something, like Hong Kong narcotics.
Yeah.
And this is the first time, and it comes up again, that Bond's revenge mission is actually jeopardizing the work of others.
That's right, yeah. So this is actually, you're right. This is actually quite interesting how you have different layers going on here. So I might have been out of line calling this a very direct Dalton film compared to Daylights, because Daylights, you know, you have lots of stuff going on with Daylights, lots of shit to work out, whereas License to Kill is a bit more of a romp. But there is stuff going on at this moment of the film that reveals itself, doesn't it?
This stuff's going on, and while it's not massively relevant, it does show that Bond's revenge, that's all he can think about. It is... Mm. At the detriment of others.
Yeah, he's very blinkered, isn't he?
You know, these guys have been saying, oh, we've been working to take down Sanchez for years. And then Bond pops up and it's like, you know, and all of a sudden... And then again, when Bond confronts Pam about meeting Heller, there's the whole plot around the CIA giving him immunity because of these missiles, and now Bond has jeopardised that as well.
Yeah.
You can see it in his face that he's realising
that. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. He's like, oh, I'm trying to take vengeance for my mate, and it turns out that, it's not just me.
I'm sabotaging everything that's going on here. Had I just got on the plane back to Blighty, this would have all been resolved without me.
Carcaridon Carcarius.
The Hong Kong police have captured Bond. They're holding him hostage, and there's a stuffy British agent there who's, I don't know whether he's from the embassy, he's sort of... turns out Bond is a rogue agent and this is property of Her Majesty's government. You know, his presence isn't explained. I mean, he could quite easily be a bookish tanner or something like that. But Heller and the tanks and Sanchez arrive and blow the shit up.
No, it's interesting, that guy who turns up. I mean, he's only in the film, he's only got like 20 seconds of dialogue. It's like, James Bond, British intelligence, we're shipping you back. But you're almost instantly wanting him to die.
He's almost like Saunders at the beginning of Living Daylights, but at least Saunders redeems himself.
He does, yeah, and you're almost sorry to see Saunders go, but then this guy, you're like, oh, yeah, we can get this guy out of the way.
But I love the way that this film sees a lot of, I call it medium level language, because Bond tells him to piss off.
I like piss off.
This is a piss off.
Yeah, no, it's a real heartfelt piss off as well, isn't it?
Yeah, the tanks, you know, very overkill, just turn up and blow this building up. They find Bond tied up, and this is where Sanchez takes him home and nurtures him, looks after him really nicely.
Yeah, so then you cut to Acapulco, and he's waking up in this mansion, And it's quite the scene, this, because apparently this is like a $32-38 million mansion in the day, them prices.
Yeah.
And the people that owned it were mates of the Broccolis. So it wasn't like it was open to the public and people can hire this out. But they said, look, you know, you can have this. It's fine. You know, come in and film. We'll be there as well. And this place is just... I've never been there. I'd love to go there. But it is very, very expansive. You know, it's got its own cinema. It's got like 12 floors, what have you. And, you know, to get this place, all they said was, look, you don't have to pay us, Broccolis, but just make a nice little donation to our charity, and, you know, and you can have the run of the place. So that was great. And, you know, you can see from the exteriors as well that it's absolutely beautiful. Think the rooms, like when Dalton wakes up, that's all done in the studio, because the rooms in the actual mansion are all filled with this weird artwork and stuff like that. So they can, even weirder than the fish that he wakes up to. But I really want to, this will be on the hit list or the bucket list for sure as a location to go to.
Where the party at the end of the film, that was at the same place, wasn't it?
Same place, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's, I think John Glenn then spotted the swimming pool and go, ah, awesome, we can just do that here. No problem.
Yeah. That makes sense. This is Bond, again, sort of building that trust with Sanchez, and that there was the lovely quote of things were about to turn nasty.
They're nasty. I love that. I can't do it, but I just love it.
And he then starts again sowing those seeds of stitching up Crest, as saying, oh, well, you know, all I know is they said that there's someone coming in to see you tonight, you know, and this is the guy who's betrayed you.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, he works out his Crest. So that evening, they go off, Crest arrives, and Bond sneaks onto the boat and plants the rest of the money that he's withdrawn from the bank.
Yeah, interesting.
It just goes to show that he's defeating Sanchez in a different way. He's not just out to kill him. He's not just out to, you know,
taking him out from under, isn't he, basically?
Yeah. And this is perhaps that revenge all along. It's not just the quick death. You know, he's actually making him sort of doubt himself.
Yeah, he's making him super paranoid. But
yeah.
I love this scene as well, because you had Carrie Lowell in this flesh-coloured bathing suit, and apparently the producers and whatnot were really worried that this would be like a see-through bathing suit and that it couldn't be used. And by the way, this is on the commentary, right? So this is not me throwing scurrilous rumors out. So apparently Cubby said, well, I've got an idea. Why don't you come round to my gaff? I've got a swimming pool, and we'll find out if it's see-through or not. So Carrie Lowell goes, yep, no problemo. She's a hot 25-year-old. So does a couple of laps in his pool, gets out, it's perfectly fine, and, you know, Cubby's like, oh, fuck. Now, that bit I did make up, he didn't say fuck, but that the whole, you know, her going to Cubby's mansion to test out this swimming costume, again, I don't think you can do that in today's climate, right?
It's crazy that it seems, I mean, that's the sort of thing I suppose Weinstein would probably do.
Exactly,
but,
yeah.
You know, she takes off this boiler suit because she's masquerading as the harbour pilot to guide this boat in, and she takes off this boiler suit, and she's just wearing this ridiculously unnecessary outfit.
Yeah.
You know, it just looks like underwear.
Yeah.
There's no sort of practical purpose to it at all.
And even Bond's looking at that going, that's just ridiculous.
And as they're putting the money into the decompression chamber, you can see, I mean, that this outfit is struggling to do its job. You know, she's almost in danger of spilling out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suppose you can look at it now and just think, what the...
But I mean, she looks fantastic. I think this is also the moment that you realise that she is worthy of being a Bond girl, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah,
but you
go,
oh my God, oh no, yeah, she is the nails. I mean, she is just absolutely inch perfect.
And this is the, I suppose, very gruesome Crest death.
End of Crest, yeah. Yeah, this is quite a way to go. I don't even really know what a decompression chamber is on that boat. I was going to Google it, but ran out of time. Obviously, related to fishing, and it's got to do something. It's got to compress something, but...
Well, yeah, I suppose it would depend on how deep the diving, because if they're sort of marine exploration.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Sanchez must know what he's doing.
Right,
you know, he starts fiddling with all these tools and then takes an axe to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, that was, again, just... unpleasant.
Brutal way to go.
But Bond stays to watch.
Yeah.
But we do get the awesome line of, because bear in mind, there's $4.9 million of the money, and your Crest is saying, that's not my money. And Sanchez can know it's mine.
Yeah.
And then what do we do with the money? Launder it.
Launder it, yeah. And that got a nice laugh.
What about the money, patron?
Launder it.
Yeah. That got a nice laugh in cinema. I think, and again, that was another one. I don't know if Robert Davi came up with that line, or he really wanted to say the line because he knew that going back through the Bonds, it's the lines like that that you remember.
Yeah.
So he really wanted to be put down in the pantheon of great lines in Bond history, and this was going to be one of them. And it did get a good laugh at the cinema. I remember that.
Definitely. Yeah. So now we come to the end game. We go off to the meditation chapel thing. We've got Q in a sombrero and a moustache and a radio broom.
Yeah.
Looking absolutely absurd.
Yeah, I love that.
But I did like the fact, because as he throws the broom into the bush once he's finished with it, apparently that was his idea of making, Desmond Llewellyn's idea of making a joke that he's always telling Bond off for not bringing the gear back.
Yeah. And just it's discards just, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. That's good. And he's
environmentally
also
friendly.
He's also like, that's fucking me done. You know, I can go hammer that check. You know, wait for the premiere. That is a real. See you later.
And we get, I mean, and the whole plot, and which I won't go into too much into detail about the how they managed to smuggle the drugs by dissolving it in petrol.
Yeah.
Or gasoline.
But it's not too far away from the truth, is it? I think there is some ways or means that you can do that.
Probably, yeah.
Apparently.
I wouldn't know.
Who knows? Yeah, someone else who does know can write it.
Yeah. This is where the businessmen pay in negotiable bearer bonds, and I just made a note saying Die Hard.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds that you have locked in your vault.
So Pam turns up and seduces Professor Joe.
Yeah.
Who has a very small role, but is very memorable just for saying bless your heart.
Right, okay. So can we talk a little bit about Wayne Newton?
Yeah, please.
Now, so Wayne Newton is a guy that if you Google him, you could just fall off the face of the earth in an internet wormhole, like for a few hours. He has just got such a history and a Wikipedia page that, you know, how someone's not done a movie of this guy's life is fantastic. So, like, one of the stories that I just peeled off was how someone gave him, like, £20 million to live in his house, or to like say, look, I want to convert your mansion into a museum. And Wayne Newton goes, sure, no problem. Took the 20 million, but didn't move, just stayed in the house. And then from there started sexually harassing all the construction workers.
Jesus.
I mean, he's been sued so many times. I mean, I know he's gone bankrupt and made his money back again, etc. But this guy had wealth beyond anyone's dreams. Lost it all, got sued, spent fortunes on lawyers, got it all back again. And now he's like late 70s, I think. And you then move on to other areas of Wayne Newton, like the plastic surgery element. And if you want to research eyelid plastic surgery, then his face just comes up everywhere. Right? And it reminds you of these face app things that we're seeing right now, where people are aging like 20 years. They're using this face app thing. Because everyone's saying that Wayne Newton looks horrible with all this plastic surgery, but you don't know what he looks like without the plastic surgery. Had he just grown old naturally? So someone needs to, I'm not going to do it, but someone needs to face app Wayne Newton 30 years from this film so that we can have a little comparison of what he would have looked like.
He could just have kids. Weirdly, one thing I noticed, he was, now I don't know very much about Wayne Newton, but he was some sort of Vegas entertainer, wasn't
That's right,
he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he was, you remember in Rocky IV when Drago fights Apollo Creed? On top billing of the MGM Grand was Wayne Newton.
No, that is amazing.
Above Drago and Apollo Creed.
Wow, so they were the undercard to Wayne Newton.
Well, or he was the star attraction anyway.
Huh, that's
So he must have had some sort of residency there when they were filming that.
Do you think after they got Apollo out of there that he would have gone on stage, or would have been bad taste?
Well, no, I suppose James Brown would have finished as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. Yeah, I guess so. On with the show. On with the show. Well, I didn't know that. That's really cool. So, yeah, he was this big Vegas superstar, but he knew that he didn't have much presence outside of America, or at least it wasn't a household name. And so was friends with the Broccolis for years, and each time he'd bump into him, would say, you know, what am I doing in the next movie? How's the script coming along? What have you done with me in the next movie, et cetera, et cetera. So he finally got his way through lots of pestering, got into the movie. But he's brilliant in this. He's really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, he's just this sort of sleazy sort of, I know it's a play on the sort of, and again, it's difficult, we don't really have him in the UK, but the TV evangelists You know, and he's being used as a front to basically market drug prices.
Which is such a cool idea. And so he, Wayne Newton, apparently did do all this television work back in the day and did all this fundraising over television. And yeah. on the set when they recorded this, so he just walks on. He's a natural, doesn't need the cue cards, etc. And he's so good. Like, everyone on set is just applauding, like, as soon as he's done it and it's a wrap. So, yeah, I really love this. I think this is just perfect for this guy.
It was so good. And again, I think, was it twice or three times throughout the film he said, bless your heart?
Yeah,
and they always got a big laugh in the film, in the cinema.
And I have that as a screen capture whenever I'm in a slightly weird Bond forum. And it's kickoff. I always post that picture of him and it just diffuses everything. It's nice.
Bless your heart.
So Bond gets a tour of the lab with the Japanese business. He gets ID'd by Dario from the bar. And because Dario and Sanchez have this, you know, however far back their relationship goes, no, it can't be that far because Dario's only a child, that immediately trumps anything that Bond has built up with Sanchez. Dario holds a gun to him and Bond starts chucking stuff around the lab.
Yeah,
this is where Sanchez immediately knows, right, Bond is bad news. Basically because Dario has indicated it.
And it's like, where's Dario been for most of this film? It's a bit lucky that he hasn't cropped up anywhere else, right? But
yeah,
I guess here he is, and he's telling Sanchez, he's an informer, I know him. So he then pins him down, gets him on the conveyor belt. Now this bit I really do like, because he then spits on Bond. So you get that nasty, oh, this guy's a dick. You know, he's not just a villain, but he's a bit of a dick as well. So you'd hate to be killed by this guy. Any other villain in the franchise, you think, okay, not too bad, but not Dario.
And again, I suppose spitting is kind of that insulting thing, isn't it? It's, but this supposed death, you know, being dropped into a grinder.
Yeah.
again, not that. You know, where they crush the drugs to put into the gasoline.
Yeah.
You know, was it Sanchez says, when you're up to your ankles, you'll be begging to tell me everything. When you're up to your knees, you'll be begging me, you'll kiss my ass.
Kiss my ass to kill you. Yeah. That's a good one. I like that.
And again, it's that painful death that's promised.
So when Benicio del Toro did this with the knife and cut through the wire, he actually did cut Timmy. So Timmy had to then go away and get bandaged up, go to hospital, and then come back and like complete the scene. And he still bears a scar, apparently. So
ever the pro.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, there was the grinder one is really good. I was trying to mooch through what would be a good Bond quip. You know, as soon as he gets away with it, something like what we have to do to get through the daily grind. I've also put a note saying, don't say that.
All we get in the end is, turn the bloody machine off.
I know. And that reminds me also of Speed 2. So when Sandra Bullock, like, chainsaws her way through a door and says, can you get out now? And these guys behind this door who are trapped go, I could do if you turn this thing off in my face. And so then she goes, yeah, turn the bloody machine off. I think of that film each time for some reason.
So Hela dies. That whole missile thing.
The subplot.
Seems a little bit so. Sanchez escapes with the four tankers full of, was it 2 tons of cocaine? I think it was. Bond and Pam are in pursuit, initially in a golf buggy, but then she flies the plane and he drops out the back onto the top of a moving tanker.
Right, yeah. Great stunt. Yeah, so this is, I think it's Paul Weston. I know he was the supervisor doing some of the stunts. I think it was him doing this. Or someone, Crane. I put Andy Crane, but it's not like I said, I don't know everything, hardly anything. I did read or hear that the guy that did the stunt couldn't eat like before the stunt, because if the stunt goes wrong, you need to go to hospital, and you know, having anything in your stomach affects like anesthetics and all that sort of stuff. So because they didn't have the right temperature, it wasn't conducive for the stunt, it ran over for like 4 or 5 days. So he effectively didn't eat anything for 4 or 5 days before he had to like fall off this plane onto the top of the truck.
Preparation.
Poor fellow. Commitment level.
So we've got a goon shooting a stinger at Bond, and this is how, because he's managed to get into one of the trucks, he manages to get the truck onto the side wheels. Now, when you look at the Diamonds Are Forever, when he did that with the the car, and then he just times that by 50.
I know, this is such a kick-ass stunt, isn't it? So before that, you had the two trucks going up against each other.
Yeah.
Head to head, and then one slams into the other and the other hits the edge of the cliff face, what have you. Now that apparently was not supposed to happen in such a devastating way, but it looks so fucking cool, like half of the truck folded in half for that scene. So you know, the director goes, all right, okay, well, we'll keep it in because it does look the nuts. You then have Remy Julian hired to do the stunt where he gets on eight wheels, and they had all of the stabilizers and everything good to go for this guy to help him. He goes, "Nah, don't worry about it. I've got this," and just pulls off one of the best stunts that you'll see in the movies. I think this is fantastic.
Again, this is all CGI now, probably.
I know, yeah. But I'm such a fan of Remy Julien. Can I just tell you a quick story of me going to Paris?
Yeah, cool.
So when you do the A View to a Kill and Remy Julien does the driving and he goes through the barrier and takes half the car off, I went looking for the barrier, right? And I found where the barrier was, but it's been replaced by this metal grill, and the metal grill's been all overgrown with weeds and shrublands. I thought, oh, this is so sorry. It's such an iconic place that it looks so shit now. So I wrote to the Paris Tourist Information Board and said, look, you need to do something about this. This is terrible. And they replied. They said, you're right, Pete. This is a monstrosity. So I, at the time, had quite a bit of time on my hands. I started lobbying for a petition for people to get a plaque put there for Remy Julien. I even wrote to Remy Julien and said, look, you know, I think a plaque should be here in your name and your honor, but didn't get back to me. Uh-huh. Anyway, so that's, I mean, that's what this guy is capable of. Fantastic stunts and great, great iconic stunts in movie history.
Not just driving half a Renault through Paris pretending to be Roger Moore.
Yeah. My God.
Was that number one or two in Marty's Not Roger Moore top 10?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. That was a great podcast, by the way.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I love that scene. I just love the whole car chase. It's so brief and brutal.
Yeah. Oh, my God! And in this one, Sanchez kills the little bloke because he's so annoying, pretty much.
Truman gets it.
Truman Lodge gets it because he has... Now, bear in mind, this guy looks just like a little numbers dweeb, and he suddenly decides to have a go at evil drug lord for blowing up drugs.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden that's going to affect his accounting.
Yeah, it's going to affect his bottom line. It's a weird time and place to suddenly grow a pair of balls, isn't it?
Yeah.
And go up against Sanchez. Yeah, you're right.
Your boss is carrying an Uzi, and it's like, yeah, great work, Franz.
Yeah, another $2 billion rider.
And it was said, "Oh, best chance trimming some overheads."
Yeah, time to cut. By the way, I got really excited a couple of months ago because it's Anthony Stark, I think the name of the guy who played him, added me on Twitter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I thought, wow, you know, this was massive. It still is massive. So I reached out to him immediately and said, oh, dude, we've got to get you on the podcast and blah, blah, blah. And he never got back. I think he just added me by mistake and probably muted me ever since. He's like, oh, fuck.
What have I done?
What have I done there?
Yeah. And at this point, Sanchez and Bond finally have their match-up, initially on the back of a tanker, Sanchez with a machete.
Yeah.
And, the truck crashes. And this is probably, I suppose, certainly at this point, and I suppose even subsequently only the ball-hitting scene in Casino Royale, this is where we see Bond at his most injured.
Mm. Yeah, no, he's done here. He's truly done. This is at the end of a very long hunt. He's taken a few punches and a few blows and dived off helicopters. So you see him now. And also, like, the suit. You know, I have fixation on the clothes all the way through the film, but the suit is just beyond deteriorated. And so this particular scene was filmed, like, in the hottest place on Earth out in Mexico. I think it reaches, like, 130 or 140 degrees Fahrenheit out there. And the name of the place is called something like the Rumoroso, which means the rumors of the wind. And it's littered with abandoned, burnt-out vehicles where drivers have gone over the edge and killed themselves. So it's a brutal place. It sounds like the backdrop to the Titty Twister in Industrial Dawn, right? You just have all these abandoned trucks with skeletons in them, etc. So the actual scene, and then you've got Dalton after he sets light to Sanchez, run away from the explosion. But that's actually him in the foreground as well, which I love. Mm. And you can actually see it. So every kind of point where the explosion goes, you have one explosion, then another explosion. So they will like very... It goes off in lots of different ways and different areas and at different times, this explosion. And you have Dalton kind of skipping along forward at each moment of the explosion. I think this looks really good.
And one of the iconic photos, really, of the Taschen book was Timothy Dalton setting fire to, it was Paul Weston, I think, who went up in flames. You know, that's actually him, you know, getting that close to that and then running away. I mean, what a way to go. But the fact that he uses the Felix lighter.
Yes.
To
so
do
that's
it.
The payoff. That's the payoff, isn't it?
Because, you know, as Sanchez raises the machete, he just says, don't you want to know why? Now, That bit, I kind of... It's difficult because obviously it makes perfect sense to Bond.
Yeah.
But to Sanchez, it's like, no, you're just getting a lighter out.
Well, he takes a time to read it, doesn't he, I think? So he looks at it, and I think that's what he wants him to know, is that it's from lighter.
It's not obvious that he gets to read it, I suppose.
Well, because there's now, you're right here, though, because don't you want to know why? Because there's such a delay in between him, you know, showing it to the audience. You know, Sanchez has got the machete behind his shoulder ready to come down.
Yeah.
Because there's like that 2 or 3 seconds, he's probably glanced at the engraving there and thought, oh, wow. And he's probably also thought, wow, that's a cool lighter. Is that Dunhill? Fuck. <Roller gas? laughs> Yeah, it's a nice payoff.
He's going to have more than acne scars after that, isn't he?
Yeah. I'm going to have a look to see what other actors are on that blog. I didn't actually go all the way through the blog. It was just Robert Darby I researched.
And so after this, Bond goes back and makes a phone call to Felix, who's in hospital. And this is something that people always seem to raise. He's in a remarkably good mood.
Yeah,
his wife has been vaped and murdered. He's missing a leg and bits of an arm, and he's clean in the hospital. And I suppose if his best mate has gone off and killed the guy who did it, then yeah, that's would make you feel a little bit better. But
I know it's quite jarring, isn't it? It's almost like the Nordberg scene at the end of Naked Gun. Hey, buddy, I'll be up and good as new in a week.
And again, it just seems so strange. I mean, it's. Again, just kind of that typical happy ending. And I remember when my youngest daughter was, we were in the hospital waiting for her to be born, Marty put something on these Thunderballs Twitter saying, I'll put a tribute to a Bond scene, you know. And I did one of, because we were in the hospital, I actually kicked my heavily pregnant wife out of the bed, laid in the bed and hand wrote a sign saying he disagreed with something that ate him.
Nice.
And used the phone from the little thing that you got to pay about £20 a minute for. I did ask the midwife if she wanted to be in there and pretend to plump my pillows, and she went, no. She's just kind of went, no, and wandered off.
But, yeah, your wife's dilating over here. Maybe we need to get back to her.
Yeah, when my daughter's old enough to explain, I say, yeah, less than 24 hours before you were born, daddy was dicking about playing Felix Leiter.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one.
I should have tried to hide my leg, but that would have been a bad taste. And yeah, so the final part is the party at Sanchez's villa. Bond arrives with Lupe. Now, we haven't talked about Lupe a huge amount, but she at one point declared her love for Bond after he shagged her.
Yeah.
I suppose he's magic. And Pam arrives with Q. And as soon as Pam sees Bond with Lupe, she gets really jealous and storms off again.
Yeah. So she goes off and has a bit of a cry.
Yeah.
And Timmy goes, oh, you know, I'm sure you and El Presidente will be perfectly good to each other. And then leaps off the balcony. Now, I did think about this scene as well, Rich. So I was thinking, like, where do I rate Dalton? As we're coming to the end of the discussion here of License to Kill, after 3 hours, which has mainly been me going, could I talk about this? Could I talk about that? So thanks for indulging me. But as we get to, like, the end scene here, I was thinking, how do I rate Dalton amongst other Bonds? You know, obviously I have Roger at number one, Sean Daniel probably in that order, and Dalton probably fits in between Pierce and Georgia. Now, had Dalton misjudged the depth of the pool at this point and just dives into a football of water and just cracks his neck, I would have been, well, there you go. Well, that's a shame. But I think that reflects on how much... Now, if Roger had done that and he broke his neck, I'd be like, oh, fuck. You know, I would have really been affected. But had Timmy done it, I probably wouldn't have been overly bothered. So that, as much as I love Timmy and as much as I love these films, I wouldn't have been too bothered if he came to an untimely demiser.
I mean, it's difficult. I mean, this sort of thing happens regularly for 18-year-olds in sort of Falaraki, doesn't it? They jump off a hotel balcony into a pool.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, for me, Roger Moore was always my favourite Bond. Now, again, that's kind of the caveat that I don't necessarily think he was the best Bond. He just happens to be my favourite.
Yeah, I think exactly the same.
And I think possibly the more, because as I, you know, I hadn't read the Bond books when I was younger. I've read most of them now. And Dalton's portrayal certainly was more of the books. And I guess, you know, it's just difficult trying to rate them. I think when he talked in that Everything or Nothing video about how he couldn't do what Roger Moore did, you know, you do kind of have to weigh up the fact that, you know, those films were what they were, and this film was written with him specifically in mind, whereas even The Living Daylights was more aimed at probably Pierce Brosnan. It's difficult. I mean, I think his was probably the most brutal and the darker of the Bonds.
Yeah.
And I think the most ruthless. And I struggle to have seen Roger Moore, even Lazenby or Pierce Brosnan, pull off a revenge film.
Yeah. I mean, to the extent that Timmy did.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have this thing as well. I don't really rate Bonds. I know people kind of sit down and you do these glib listicles of top 10 Bond films. Who's your favorite? I don't really burn any calories doing that. I know that I've just said, you know, how do I sit Dalton in? But I just thought maybe I'll have something geared up in case it gets asked. But the way I see it is, if you've got the 24 Bonds there sitting in your Blu-rays, which one do you go to first? And I've always gone to the Rogers first. I'll grab Rogers and that doesn't sound right, but I'll grab Rogers and throw out a Roger more so than I would do any other film. And now once I've done I've done Roger a few times, then it makes room for, you know, the other Bond film. So that's how I know that Roger's my favourite Bond.
I mean, if you're playing that game, I probably would go for The Spy Who Loved Me.
Right, okay.
Whether I choose another Roger Moore film after that, probably not.
Right.
But The Spy Who Loved Me is my favourite Bond film.
So, Rich, can I ask, how old are you?
39.
Right, okay. So I'm 40, and I did think about this as well, that why the reason why Roger was is my favourite Bond is because, you know, I grew up in a house that was under, you know, we're living through 80s Thatcher and recession, and it's not a great time in the UK, especially for small businesses. And I had this house that, you know, whilst I had a great upbringing and a great childhood, it wasn't a whole bunch of laughs getting kicked around in the Brooker household. And Roger, when we'd sit down and watch a Roger film, it brought a lot of levity to the household. So if I now want to gravitate towards the humour side of Bond more, it's probably because I really liked watching him more so than any other Bond, because it was just pure escapism for me. Anyway, that's slightly confessional and that's one of the reasons why I have an infatuation with Roger Moore.
It's a welcome relief, but I think, I mean, I have a massive fondness for The Living Daylights because it was the first one I saw at the cinema.
Right, yeah.
And I guess I suppose I would have been 7. And I guess I would have been that age where it was this adventure and, you know, the music and the scenery and everything else would have taken me away. And I think that this License to Kill, I've probably, again, it's a grower on me. It's one that, because I didn't see it at the time and I came to it a bit later, when it's probably by then I'd started watching the Brosnan films by the time I actually got around to watching it, because, you know, things are a bit harder to get on video than all on demand as they are now. But it's strange. I mean, it probably sounds quite common and cliche that the, you know, with the Daniel Craig films, Casino Royale was so great, and the others, I just don't know. I'm still trying to make up my mind on them.
Well, the other Craig films, you mean?
Yeah, and yeah. I'm very hot and cold on them, and I'm massively looking forward to the next one. And yet when Spectre came out, you know, it was the same. It was maybe 6 weeks, a couple of months before Star Wars Force Awakens. And everyone was so excited about Star Wars, and I was more excited about Bond, and yet Spectre kind of left me a bit. Maybe I was just, because I built it up so much in my head, and it kind of was a bit of a letdown.
Right, okay.
I mean, that was not saying it was dreadful or anything, but it just...
Careful, there's Bond fans out there.
Exactly. Well,
we're like Radiohead.
We are.
Yeah. As a Radiohead, we'll come after you.
But then, to be fair, I kind of said I was indifferent to For Your Eyes Only and Octopussy as well. So.
Right, okay. Well, look, you know, it's... I mean, a lot of people, I think, were let down by Spectre. I personally thought it was fantastic. But again, that's the beauty of these films, is that... And probably... the pros and cons to it is because it's always got other films within the franchise to marry up against.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the longer the line you go down, the more people have a nostalgic, fuzzy, warm feeling towards the Shawns and the Rogers. And you go, well, there's no way this is as good as any of those other films. So exactly. By that rationale, it must be shit, which is not really a great... But that's one of the barometers for the new Bond films that come out. It has to be compared naturally to all the others.
And unlike this, I guess Bond 25 probably isn't going to close with a winking fish.
Well, it's got to have some kind of winking fish in there somewhere, you know, at some point down the line.
I guess, you know, Roger Moore said farewell to the role with a in a shower, and Timothy Dalton said goodbye with a winking fish. So Daniel Craig's got a lot to live up to.
He does, it'd be fascinating to see how he goes out.
Anyway, Pete, that was License to Kill. Now, brilliant. One of your projects from Tailors with Love, it's one of the podcasts I subscribe to, listen to regularly. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so the From Tailors with Love podcast is the podcast I host with Matt Spacer, who is the editor of The Suits of James Bond. And he is really just the rain man for Bond Suits. I mean, he just knows everything. It's incredible. So we started a podcast about a year ago because we wanted to talk about the style and fashion, and it loosely comes in around brands of James Bond. I go on a load of tangents, and then Matt brings me back in. So he's like the reins. And I should... can we just talk a little bit as an addendum to the podcast about the fashion of License to Kill? Because Matt sent me over some information, and I'll just read this off verbatim because it's from Roger's book, Bond on Bond. And it's actually a really interesting passage. So I'll just read this off if you don't mind. Roger says, "After I hung up Jimmy's tuxedo, Timothy Dalton took over, and his interpretation of Bond went back to the books with a more edgy, tougher style. His clothes were largely his own choice from ready-to-wear shops, and as a result, were much more casual and loose-fitting than ever before. Timothy went as far to say that he felt more comfortable wearing the off-the-peg range than any of the designer suits supplied. Some say he looked a little too ordinary for Her Majesty's Secret Service, with not enough occasions for black tie and more formal outfits. But maybe they miss the point of being a spy in that he should blend into the background and the times." So Timothy goes to say, "I cut the wardrobe down by 3/4. Bond was never flash or ostentatious. In fact, he really wore a uniform, a dark suit, navy blue. He was very navy blue. He wasn't a wealthy man. He used his money to buy the best that he needed, but then he kept it." So Timothy said in this interview in Rolling Stone magazine. "For his second film, License to Kill, costume designer Jody Tillon, who came fresh from the TV series Miami Vice, suggested a few ideas, much to the chagrin of her new 007. She wanted to put me in pastels," said Dalton in an interview with Garth Pierce. "Can you imagine?" I thought, "No, we can't have that. The clothes say so much about Bond. He's got a naval background, so he needs a strong, simple colour like dark blue." So, you know, whilst he gets derided a lot for being a very unstylish Bond, it was really him trying to bring it back down to a more gritty and realistic interpretation of Bond. So I thought that was interesting. I thought it might be interesting.
You know, Fleming's books were famous for being very detailed about brands and the designers and that side of things, you know, that Bond did have fancy tastes around certain things. And I mean, while it's not obvious, you know, Bond doesn't wear clothes that have logos all over them. There's enough blogs and websites out there, but we also know that Daniel Craig's Bond, for example, wears in most cases very high-end clothing. And yet Dalton's Bond certainly doesn't give off the impression that he does.
Exactly. And so what I take issue with is with some people that go, look, it's not Timmy's fault, it's the costume designer's fault. Timmy actually had a real big say in the clothes here. So, you know, if you want to say that he did look a bit drab and miserable, then Timmy is to blame. But if you want to say he looked realistic and gritty and it's cemented in reality, then Timmy, you know, should be accoladed for this. But the way I subscribe to Bond is that he is ready for any occasion. You have him in Spectre, for example, where he's going straight from Solden to Morocco. He's on a train, he's in a fight in an ivory dinner jacket with Hinks. You know, he's off the train in the middle of fucking nowhere. He's in a Bruno Cucinelli suit and he looks the mustard just because that's Bond. And, you know, and Bond is ready for any occasion. And he doesn't turn up like, oh, would he really have a suit in this occasion? Go, yeah, why not? He's Bond.
Got to have some escapism. Otherwise, we're going to go through every film in forensic detail.
But anyway, so that's the podcast. Thank you. From Tailors with Love, listen to Matt because he knows his onions truly about the subject. And we kind of just bash a few ideas around on that.
Well, let's say it's essential listening. And for someone like me who has a fascination with Bond, and it's still great to learn something new every week or every episode.
Thanks, pal.
Well, so that's License to Kill, and that's the end of Bond, or official Bond anyway, as far as this podcast is concerned. There may be an episode of Never Say Never Again at some point in the future. Who knows?
Yeah.
I should do it at some point.
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. That'd be fantastic.
Haven't done a Connery one yet. So
I know there's a guy on your Twitter handle that's hankering for a bit of Never Say Never Again, isn't he?
Yeah,
forget the gentleman's name.
I will have to scratch that itch at some point. Mm-hmm. Well, as is what supposedly the tradition of podcast is to play out podcast with a song that was number one at the time of the film's release. Now it was 14th of June 1989. Unfortunately for some, that was Sealed with a Kiss by Jason Donovan. So no.
That blows. Yeah.
What I will do is I will play Dirty Love in the soundtrack because hey ho, it's Dirty Love. Pete, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rich. Thanks for inviting me on.
My pleasure, and speak to you soon. We look for someone who captures our eye. What we don't count on becomes a surprise. Yeah! She's no good. This podcast is brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, and Andy Elliott, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, and more. Don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes and subscribe to be the first to hear new episodes.